Succession number 29752, reel number 1.
You, and I hope that I can give you the information that you want in time for your use. After we left England, we went on the Queen Elizabeth, and we landed up near Scotland, and from Scotland we were transported by train at night, and we went from there to Kingscliff, which is outside of Peterborough. While at Peterborough, we had to wait some time for our new planes to arrive and for our equipment to catch up with us, but we enjoyed some of English life and made frequent visits into Peterborough. While we were there, we had a dance and learned to meet some of the girls stationed around the area. Our planes finally arrived, and we went through training of all kinds, lectures from the RAF on intelligence and escape and use of simple words in the French language, and we did identification of aircraft by way of silhouettes, and we were indoctrinated into navigation and the use of your maps and navigation equipment. And after training from January, February, and March, we finally were transferred down near the coast to Horsham St. Faith, which was in Norwich. And we started our combat in April. The field was an old RAF base, which had all the comforts of home with central heating in our barracks, and it was a nice improvement over our setup in Kingscliff. Horsham was a grass field that was quite large, which enabled us to take a whole squadron off at a time, which meant that we could get our group in the air in a very short length of time and form for our mission of the day. We had a wonderful arrangement there while it lasted, and we flew there for several months. Our first missions were what we call milk runs, where really little or nothing was done more than to get us familiar with the fact that we were over enemy territory. We saw a lot of flak shot up at us. We saw very few enemy aircraft, and very little happened in the way of action. But after about 2 or 3 weeks of this, we suffered some severe losses. Seems like to me it was over the Holland-Belgium area. And we lost several of our boys who were our original boys. And this kind of shook us up a little bit. We realized that they were playing for keeps and that this wasn't just all fun and games. Our first victory was scored down near, I think it was near Cherbourg, and I was in the flight. It was Cook's flight, and he shot down our first plane, and I was leading his element in his flight. I saw his victory and confirmed it, and I never got to fire my guns that day. I only was able to score 2 victories, and outside of shooting up a lot of buoys and on a couple of abortions, I used my guns a few times on ground targets, but I only had 2 victories, the last of which was, I remember it because it was on Armistice Day, November the 11th, and this was 1943. I went down on December the 5th of 1943. During this period, I had gone with the group. We were transferred again, this time to a rather crude base that was down south of where we were, a town called Halesworth, a small little village, and it did have permanent runways. After we left Horsham St. Faith, incidentally, it was turned into a bomber base, and they put in permanent runways. At Halesworth, we again, on the occasion of our 100th victory and our 200th victory, we had wonderful dances, and one of our squadron dances, which was the last one that I attended, I was responsible for bringing in about 100 girls from nearby bases with the help of the Red Cross. And after a party evening, I did not indulge to the extent that I wasn't able to fly the next day, but one of the boys in our squadron wasn't able to make it, and I was asked to take his place. I was scheduled for a leave, and as a favor, to take Dauphin's place, who was pretty inebriated, I was offered a 5-day pass instead of a 3-day pass. I never got to take that pass. I was flying an old plane. I had a brand new one, but it had never been slow timed. I hadn't finished slow timing it, and the guns hadn't been fired in. So I had to leave my brand new plane sitting on the tarmac, and I had to take my old plane, which had more combat time on it than any other plane in my squadron at the time. And when I took off, my prop was surging badly, and I really should have aborted. But to abort was almost a sin, because if things checked out properly, you felt awfully guilty, and people looked askance at you. But anyhow, after joining the formation and with the bombers that we were to escort in sight, I decided I couldn't finish this mission, and I called Dave Schilling, who was leading the group that day, and I told him that I was leaving. He told me to take my wingman with him. My wingman's name was Kelly, and he stayed with me, and I originally headed back to the coast trying to get home, but even in manual now, my prop was acting up, and I began to lose power, and I got an electrical fire aboard, and I had to bail out. I inverted to bail out, and when I bailed out, I hit one of my legs on the tailplane, and I got a severe cut. Kelly, of course, went on back to the base and reported that he saw me bail out safely. I was above clouds when I bailed out, so he quickly lost sight of me because I was down near the cloud layer when I bailed out. When I got to the ground, I had the misfortune to land on a cow, and that hurt my back. And when some of the peasants and farmers that lived near the area saw me come down, and they were quick to gather my chute and hide it and take some of my equipment away from me, and they told me to run. I started to run, but I realized that my leg was hurt. I didn't know until now that I had hurt my leg, but then I saw that blood was coming through my flying suit. And I headed for a haystack, and I hid in the haystack. I stayed there for quite some time, and finally a farmer who obviously owned the haystack came out to use his outdoor outhouse. And when he was in his privy, I went to the door, blocked it, and let him know that I was an American airman. I was armed, and I needed help. Would he help me? And he was quick to convey to me that he would help me. And with the few French words that I had, he seemed to understand. And when I let him out of the privy, he told me to follow him, and we went on up to the house. He first looked at my leg, cleaned it up a little bit for me, and put a temporary bandage on it. He had some soup on his stove, and I had not eaten since early that morning, and it was now well afternoon, and he joined me in having some hot soup for lunch. And after he got me comfortable, he had me sitting by a wood stove in the kitchen. He told me to wait there, and he would be back in a little while. It seemed like it was a long time, but he finally came back, and when he did, he was with another gentleman. And the other gentleman wanted to see my dog tags, and he wanted some identification, wanted to know what squadron and so forth, and he made some notes, and he said, "You stay here, and we will let you know as soon as we can properly identify you." That night, the same gentleman came back, accompanied by still another person. The other person was introduced to me as a doctor. No name was given. He made it known that he would rather not give his name because he was Jewish, and he said he was most happy to help me, and he understood that I too was Jewish, and he said, "You must not convey anybody's name, because if anybody is caught, it could mean death for any of us." He cleaned and bandaged my leg, and a gentleman who had come originally to identify me let me know that he had already heard from London by shortwave radio, and that they were satisfied with my identification, that I was who I said I was, and they were going to try to help me. He said, "Now you will stay here with the gentleman that owns this little farm, and you will hear from us soon." That night, he put me up in a feather bed upstairs. He let me know that he was a widower, that he had lost his wife several years ago, and that he says that he has nothing to lose. And he hated the Germans, and he would do anything that he could to help defeat them, and he hoped that he could be of some help by letting me stay there. And I thanked him, and I went to bed early that night and wondered what was ahead for me. A few days later, I was beginning to get impatient, and I conveyed this to the farmer who was befriending me and letting me stay in his house. And he said he can't do anything until he hears from others. And sure enough, that evening, there's a knock on the door, and a gentleman comes in. And I thought to myself, I'm going to be arrested. It was a policeman, but it was a French gendarme, and he was the only policeman in this little village. And he said, "Come with me, and we're going to another house." And he had a bicycle for me, and we went by bicycle, all of us, the gentleman that I was staying with, whose name I don't know, and the gendarme, and myself, and the three of us on bicycles went to a house a few little farms away. All of these little farms, incidentally, were all walled in near the street, with the farms back away from the road that passed through the village. And we went to another house, and there must have been, I guess, about six or seven couples. It was quite a gathering for a small home. And they were throwing a party in my honor. And after they drank to France and drank to America and drank to my fighter group, and they served some cookies and a lot of wine and I can't even think of the name of it now, but the famous French brandy that everyone seems to drink over there. We broke up for the evening, and along with the gendarme, I should say the gendarme and myself, just the two of us. We went out into the night, and I followed him on his bicycle, and he said, if anybody stops, he says, you let me do the talking. And we went by several German troops, and no one stopped us, and we went directly to his house. And at his house, I met his wife, an attractive lady, and she was very friendly and wanted to make me at home. And she sat me down in her husband's easy chair and had me put my bad leg up on a stool. And we sat and talked for a while. They spoke little to no English, and I spoke little to no French. So we were sitting there with dictionaries trying to make ourselves understood, and we carried on something of a conversation. And I guess everybody soon tired of it, and we all went to bed. The next morning, the gendarme left, and I could hear the door open and close, and I heard them say goodbye, and I was laying in bed wide awake. And in a little while, the wife comes up with a tray and breakfast. And I told her I could come down for breakfast. She says, no. She says, I'll brought your breakfast up. And she sat there while I ate. She was sitting there smiling, and I felt kind of stupid because I really couldn't converse with her. We seemed to manage to be able to make ourselves understood, but there wasn't much of a conversation. She left after a while, and she says, I'll be back. I have to clean up downstairs and so forth. And in a little while, she comes back to get the tray. And I had gotten up and started to dress myself, and she says, let me help you. And she helped me somewhat, and she was a little more than friendly for somebody else's wife. She kept sitting next to me and helping me put my clothes on, and she says, come downstairs and you can sit and keep warm by the fire. This was now roughly the middle of December, so it was pretty cold out. And I sat down by the fire, and I wasn't sitting there long, and she seemed to be finishing her house cleaning. And she pulls a chair up alongside me, and she's got her dictionary in her hand, and she looks up the word for love. And I said, oh, yes, I love everybody. And pretty soon it was very clear to me what she had in mind. And I told her, no, we shouldn't be doing anything like that because you're a married woman. And I'm taking advantage of being in your house, and I can't do that. And she was quite persistent. And she was persistent to this extent. She says, either you make love or I'll turn you in for the reward that I can get for you. We made love. Anyhow, this went on for the better part of a week. As soon as her husband would leave, she would want to get in bed. And I couldn't wait to get out of this situation because I was so afraid if that man came back and caught us in the act that I would never see the end of this war, and I'd be killed by a friendly bullet. Anyhow, after approximately a week's time, one evening when he came home, he said, get your jacket, get your coat, put your hat on. We're leaving. We're going somewhere. Again, we got our bicycles, and we went down the road for a bit, and we pulled off and into a field, and near a tree there was a pickup truck that had a body on it. And we took our bicycles, and they were the type of bicycles that would fold to be the size of one wheel so that one wheel would be on top of the other. And we put the bicycles in the back of the truck, and then they had me get in the back of the truck, and they closed the doors. And The next thing I knew, we were bumping down the road, and soon we were on a hard surface road, and I had no idea where we were going. But after being on the road for a little bit, we stopped, and we stopped at a friend's house, and again they pulled out the whiskey, and we drank toasts around to everybody, and after being introduced to his friends, we continued to go toward Amiens. And when we got to Amiens, couldn't see where we were going, but we went over a cobblestone street, and I could hear a train in the background, so I knew we were somewhere near a train station. And we stopped, and getting out into the black of night where everything is blacked out, couldn't see a thing. They knocked on this door, and someone came to the door, a little old lady, and we all went in. The entrance to the street was shut off with curtains, so you could see no light. And after they closed the door, then they opened the curtains, and we stepped into the house. This was Madame Vion's house. Madame Vion was in charge of the Somme sector of the French underground. She was a little lady up in age. I dare say she was in her 60s. And she was small and rather obese, but a very stern person on first introduction, and apparently all business. But I soon found that she had a heart inside of her that was bigger than you could imagine. She carried an automatic pistol in her apron pocket. And after being introduced, my gendarme friend and his friend left. And Madame Vion spoke fairly good English, and we were able to converse at length. And she was most hospitable. Again, she was quick to inquire about my leg, and she redressed my leg, and she wanted to know if I'd had any supper, and I had not. And we sat down, and we had something to eat. I don't recall. It was some vegetables out of her garden, and there was some hot soup and some bread. And she shared whatever she had, but there wasn't much in the house. And the next day, she introduced me to her grandchildren. They came over, and one of them's name was Claude, and the sister was Lily. And we got along great together, and they would frequently come over after school and play with me, and Lily was a great help in teaching me a little French, and we got along very well. She had a walled-in garden behind her house, which gave me a chance to have fresh air, and I could walk a little in the garden, and it was the roomiest quarters that I'd had so far since I'd been down, and I felt quite comfortable with her. Madame Vion, as I say, was in charge of the French underground in this area. So everything started and stopped at her house. If there was any sort of a raid to be made in the area, it was planned at her house. If somebody needed some extra coupons for milk or butter, she's the one that would print them. If someone needed an identification, a forged identification, she would make it up for them. She did everything. And she was an all-business sort of a lady. But again, she let it be known that the Germans took her husband away from her during the First World War, and she hated the Germans. And I was quite sympathetic to her feelings, but after being with her for a very short while, we became attached, and I called her my Madame Mama Douzième. And She truly was a second mother. And she did not want me to leave. I was anxious to leave, but she didn't want me to leave. She said, wait for the invasion. Let them come to you. She says, you'll be caught, and if you're caught, they will probably shoot you because you're Jewish. And she says, I am so afraid for you. And she really had a sincere interest in my well-being. But I told her that it was my duty to try to get back. So she planned an escape for me by way of a fishing boat, which I briefly mentioned in the letter that I wrote to you. And the night that I was supposed to go, we were all packed up and ready to go to meet this boat that was to rendezvous out in the channel with either a patrol boat or a submarine. And they said, don't go, go back in the house. They've caught all of our people, and the people who had the boat, their boat has been confiscated, and this is off. And so that was a big letdown. I was all prepared and ready to go, and when this happened, I was very disappointed. This was now the end of December. Again, I let Madame Vion know that I was anxious to go. She again asked me to reconsider, not to go, but to stay. Upon my insistence, she says, all right, and another plan took shape. A gentleman came over and brought me the cockpit layout and plans of an FW-190. They made it known that there was a crew chief at the airport of aerodrome of Glisi, which was just outside of Amiens, which, of course, the Germans occupied with their fighter outfit there. And one of the crew chiefs was married to a French girl, and she in turn had persuaded her husband to help us, and he was to play the part of the hero by allowing me to make believe that I knocked him out when the plane was being taxied by a place where I was to hide alongside of the taxiway on the way to the revetment where the plane was normally kept in the evening. And I familiarized myself with the cockpit layout, knew where all the controls were, and they had marked on these diagrams the best glide speed and all. And at that time, we were not familiar with anything but miles per hour rather than kilometers. And everything was marked so that I knew where the red lines were, knew where my handle was to retract my gear and to put down my flaps, etc. And I felt competent to fly the plane, saw where the prop controls were and so forth, and where the gun controls were, and I was quite ready. And I put everything to memory in a fairly short length of time. Then after, it was right after the Christmas celebration, and she had a little celebration over her house, and she had John, which was her son, and he worked nearby. He was not conscripted or anything. He was allowed to work at a job, and his two children, who were Claude and Lily, they were there, and also John's wife was there, and there was another young lady, a very attractive young lady, and she was there, and then Madame Vion was there, and one of her neighbors who she introduced as a professor, I don't recall any of the names, actually. Most of these people only identified themselves by their first names. And we had a nice dinner. Practically everybody had brought something, and it was a very nice dinner. And it was sort of like a farewell dinner in my honor. The next night, I went with this young lady who had come to dinner, and she and I went on bicycles to this farm right near this airport of Glisi. And we checked in with them, left their bicycles there, and then she and I secreted ourselves alongside of the taxi strip where we were to overpower this crew chief when he taxis by very slowly. I was to supposedly hit him in the head, and he was going to jump out, and then I was to take the plane. And from that position, I could cut right across the field and take off. Well, what happened was we waited and waited and waited, and no plane showed up.